And welcome to another episode of the Pixel Drone Show, the show where we talk to industry professionals about how they use drones in their field of expertise. Today, we're really excited because we have a drone manufacturer, and you may have heard of them, Paladin. We have Divi Srivastava with us, who's the founder of Paladin. They have a purpose-built drone, and we'll talk about all the detail because it's pretty cool. It's not something that we've really ever discussed before in the show. So before we get started, Divi, welcome to the show.
Yeah, Greg, thanks for having me. This is super exciting. The setup is very professional. Very excited to be here and talk drones.
Well, we're really excited too. We met in Texas a couple of weeks ago. Actually, I saw your booth, and then we met afterwards at one of the party. And it's exciting because you guys are doing something slightly different. So I can't wait to hear more. But you started Paladin back in 2018. Can you tell us before that how you get to that point and what gets you into drones?
Yeah, great question. So just as an overview, at Paladin, we deploy autonomous drones to 911 calls. And happy to go into details for that later. But this company and this idea started when I was in high school. It was 2016, and I just finished high school. I was about to head off to college when my friend's house burnt down. And I grew up in this really tight-knit Indian immigrant community in Lewis Center, Ohio. And this fire had a massive impact on me and everybody I knew. So I started talking to my local fire chief, Chief Noble, and he told me that a fire doubles in size every 30 seconds. He also told me first responders and he also told me that first responders never have enough information when they arrive on scene. And that just blew my mind. But I started thinking about it, and when I went off to college, I talked to more and more firefighters, and that same problem kept coming up, this lack of situational awareness. So after looking into it, talking to more people, I realized that when someone calls 911, they're already panicking.
Yeah.
All they see is a massive fire that might kill them, or they're driving down the highway, they saw smoke on one side or the other. But that person isn't necessarily trained to say that this is a two-story structure fire, showing signs of early collapse, for example, or what the surrounding conditions are, if there's vegetation, if there are vehicles nearby. What's the profile of the house? It's no one's fault, it's just the way it is. And after talking to more and more firefighters, I was studying engineering at that time, and I knew how to fly drones a little bit and figured maybe there's something I can do to help. So that's where the idea really came about, where if you don't have information, what if you could? And drones were just taking off. I had this, I think I'd gotten the Phantom 3 Advanced or something like that just to play around with, but started building something on top of that. And one thing led to another, and now we've been responding to thousands of calls, helping first responders every single day.
That's awesome.
That's really awesome. So I spent some considerable time in Silicon Valley. I'm familiar with Crunchbase. So when I was doing a little research, I saw it pop up and noticed that you raised a seed round. Congratulations. How have you put that to use? And are you going to seek more funding in the future? Do you plan to expand a lot more?
Yeah, so we had raised a pre-seed round early 2019. Led by some great investors. And most of that money was to be used to build this platform for 911 calls. For those who don't know, this drone industry is very regulated. And there are a lot of safety procedures, rightly so, that need to be mitigated or need to have solutions for. So that entire round has been used to work very closely with the FAA, work very closely with some select clients, and build a system that actually hopefully does what they need it to do, which is give situational awareness. Mm. And today we're live in several cities. We're onboarding several more today. We've had some really great wins with the FAA, making sure to getting waivers, making sure that we have waivers to conduct these operations safely. And we're very excited to see what really these next couple of months look like, because we're about to start deploying over several cities, and we've gotten, everything is a step-by-step process. There are a lot of waivers that need to come into place. There are a lot of meetings with decision makers, but this is what I think is going to be a huge part of the future of first response. And we're very excited to be a part of that.
It sounds like you're growing fast. And my question would be my next follow-up question. How many employees do you have right now?
The team right now is 10 people, and we're a mix of engineers and first responders. the reason we've built this in the first place is we know this technology will save lives. And it's really exciting to be able to bring on more and more team members who are motivated for that exact same mission. What started as, you know, just really a college project is now hopefully turning into a company and a product that will help first responders save lives.
That's awesome. I think it's already an awesome story, and we're just at the beginning of this interview, so I can't wait until we start digging deeper and learning more about this. How many different drone models do you guys currently produce?
So, great question. When we started as a company, we didn't make drones. We made pure software to make these drones autonomous for the purpose of still sending it to 911 calls. And we used a lot of great drones that are available today. But they just weren't getting the job done, especially when we were trying to send these drones beyond visual line of sight. We would be losing connection and had to essentially re-architect the entire system. So we started in really in 2021 working on our new platform, which we've released a couple months ago, called Nighthawk. And there is only one drone. It's one frame, and its main purpose is to be this repeatable system that can be sent to 911 calls. It's just one drone, has about a 55-minute battery life, has our own autonomous communication and range, and we routinely fly this beyond visual line of sight in our cities that we've gotten waivers in. And it's been it's the start of what we're hoping is going to be a great platform for everyone to use.
So speaking of the drone, what kind of payload are you using under? Do you have, I'm assuming thermal, probably obviously RGB as well, and anything else that that you can use out there to help first responders?
Yeah, we actually have a customizable payload. It just depends on what a city needs. So standard, our drone will come with a 10x optical zoom camera. This is used daily, going to responses in the daylight. Even if we're going to fire alarms, being able to get a 360 view of exactly what's happening, get more situational awareness. We also offer thermal payloads, dual payloads, spotlights, whatever a department really needs. Our recommended payload is usually a dual payload with thermal and optical zoom. And we have several different models, but the one we recommend is usually a 640p thermal camera paired with either 20 or 30 times optical zoom, 1080 or 4K camera.
And you say 55 minutes of flight time. What's the size of this drone? I mean, I know I've seen it, but I want you to tell people how big it looks.
I'll be honest. I don't have the exact measurements off the top of my head. But if you're it's less than a yard by a yard. It's in the same class as some other heavy lift drones.
Yeah, it's a heavy lift.
Yeah.
I've heard you mention the words autonomous drones and autonomy a couple of times now. Can you explain to us what the importance of autonomy is when it comes to drones that help in first responder type situations?
Yeah, I think a lot of firefighters and police officers have been seeing the benefits of drones. They've either been getting budgets from departments to buy smaller drones and starting using them, or they just buy them themselves because they see the benefit. And today's model is usually around firefighters or officers arrive on scene. If they are pilots, they have their units with them. And after arriving on scene, they can use that drone to gain additional information. And this is a model that is working really, really well. Arrive on scene with the unit, train yourselves, and get that information. It's saving lives today.
Does that mean that the drone is intended to get there first, basically?
That's how we look at it. Yeah. There are so many responsibilities that first responders already have when they are responding to an emergency. And our goal is to make it as easy for them as possible to gain that information they need without necessarily needing to control an entire drone, because it's not the easiest thing. You know, you guys have a phenomenal program for training people, and that's helping push the envelope. Not every department, unfortunately, can do that. And autonomy for us is more of a safety precaution. If we're able to say, hey, with the touch of one button, literally touching one button on a laptop, you can get a drone on scene in 90 seconds or less with full control of it should you need to take over manually. You know, that takes a lot of the operational, that takes a lot of the operational things out of the picture. It makes it simpler to fly drones. Now, our goal is, instead of having a drone that's taking off after first responders arrive on scene, this is a resource that's stationed at a fire station, central point in the city. And instead of waiting for first responders, this should be a unit that just goes to the scene almost immediately.
Yeah. I also think I heard you say that there was a platform for everyone to use. Do you mean like your platform being the software platform as well as the drone as a package for every city to potentially use? Or do you mean other drones might be able to use that same platform, like existing drones that might already be out there in the hands of fire departments, for instance?
Yeah, I was referring mainly to the fact that our platform is made for firefighters, police officers. It's one area, one website, one application that everyone can access throughout a city. Beyond that, we do have integrations with other manufacturers because there are great drones out there and it doesn't make sense to not work with them. There are so many great companies making things for first responders, building phenomenal products, and I think it's a disservice to the industry to not work together and build really the best product possible.
I agree. And I think what we've heard in our conversations with people that work as first responders is that a lot of times their budgets are limited. So if they've already invested in certain hardware, it would be smart, I guess, to be able to use that.
Yeah. And our goal still is to have autonomous drones that are responding to emergencies.
Yeah.
That's been the goal since 2018. That's been the mission. And that's what we spent such a long time trying to understand how to do. There's a lot of operational things, a lot of tech things, a lot of waivers. In doing so, we've built technology that works with other drones. So why not make things that work for everybody?
Yeah, makes sense.
So two weeks ago, we were talking to Romeo Dersher from Otarian, and that's kind of, I don't know if you're familiar with them, but that's kind of their product is to make sure that everything is standardized. Is this something that we can expect to see in your drones eventually? Are you guys thinking of doing this kind of work with a platform that would be more open source?
So we currently use open source code for our drones right now. In working with other people, we're basically saying, hey, this drone exists, and if you guys want to work with us, let's please have a conversation and just see where that goes. Our goal is to work with whatever is the best system out there. And if someone brings something out that's, you know, better than what we have, great. Let's see what we can do and work together to make a better product. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, absolutely.
So how and where are your drones manufactured?
Our drones are all manufactured here in Houston. I'm actually at our office right now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, here's a skeleton frame. I don't know if you guys can see it. So we usually get a lot of, we get parts manufactured from different people across the country and internationally. And everything is then put together here, soldered, wired together. It sometimes gets a bit messy, but everything is tested here because our first clients were in Houston. And we soon realized that if we're going to build our own hardware, at least something for DFR specifically, it just works better to be able to do everything here. Our process today is we build the drone, we test it in Houston. We had to make sure that it would work in Houston weather, in the scorching heat, the humidity, the rain. And that's, I think, helped us build a more rugged platform so far. And we really believe in building drones for the environments we're going to be flying in. So might as well test them here.
Is that going to be the new saying? If you can fly it in Houston, you can fly it anywhere?
I don't know if there's a direct connect to there. We're still doing significant testing in cold areas with obviously snow and sub-zero temperatures. But Houston's presented its own challenges, and we've been fortunate to be able to tackle them and have a great team just solving day in and day out.
I've been to Houston a couple of times, and I remember how hot and humid it can be down there in the summertime. Now, I applaud you, first of all, by the way, for manufacturing drones and designing and developing them here in the United States. I mean, we've spoken to a few people who are trying to do that, and quite successfully, actually. I give you a lot of credit for that, because people seem to think that manufacturing always needs to take place in the Far East, and you're an example of that not necessarily being true. Do you have any ambition to make your drones become part of the Blue SUAS program, the manufacturers in the United States drones?
Yeah, we're always happy to have in conversations with them. Blue UAS is a great list, especially with the new version, with the new list that they've released of drones that are built in the United States, and we're seeing how we can be a part of that.
Awesome.
So as we all know, COVID did create a supply chain crisis, and I'm wondering if that has impacted you in any way.
It's definitely impacted us in some ways. You know, parts are definitely more difficult to come across. Prices are up. But we've been fortunate in that a lot of the things that we're working with, we can print ourselves, or we can work with several different parties, either across the US or internationally, who have different parts. It does take, it has taken more time, essentially. Lead times are higher if we want to get parts manufactured or we want to get things, you know, here fabricated. It takes a little bit more time. But, you know, we're just starting out. We haven't had to build 1,000 drones just yet. But it's good to know that even when we need to, we're very excited to be working with great partners who are capable of with handling those loads.
So you have your supply chain sorted, even in
I wouldn't say 100% sorted. There are we're constantly making changes on Nighthawk itself, right? We have a stable platform that we're using for our deployments, but we're constantly seeing, hey, this is something that isn't working. This part doesn't work as well.
Okay.
How do we change it out? We never want to be stuck with just one thing, right? Yeah. You always want to make something better.
Yes.
And every single time we fly, we get more information. We see what's working and what's not.
We see in the industry a lot of gripes from customers talking about customer service or the lack thereof with a lot of the large manufacturers. How is this a pinch point for you? How do you guys deal with this, especially being smaller, where I'm sure you have a team that's working on a lot of different things and wear a lot of different hats?
Yeah, definitely a lot of different hats. But when this company was started, I was spending 12 to 16 hours a day at a fire station just trying to understand what works and what doesn't work. I'm not a firefighter. I'm not a police officer. I don't have anybody in my family who has any type of that experience. And the only way for me to learn is to be there. And I've, again, been very fortunate to be allowed access to these places and just learn. So when we onboard customers, the number one thing is making sure that we're building something they actually want, making sure that they have access to me, my team at any time. Emergencies don't have hours. They don't have office hours. And that's the industry we're in. So it's very important to us that we're communicating with them, letting them know, hey, this is what our product can do. This is what it can't do. This is what we might be able to do. This is what we definitely won't be able to do. And in doing so, I think it's helped us build something that we're trying to roll out as quickly as we can into as many cities as we can.
Awesome.
Who would you say is your biggest competition?
Our biggest competition is every other drone company out there. I think everybody in this industry is trying to build a product that everyone can use. Mm-hmm. And there are companies who are very successful about it already. We're just trying to build something for 911 calls. So that's our very specific niche. That's what we've been doing since 2018, and that's what we're going to keep doing. And there are other companies who are now coming out with similar products. Mm-hmm. And we're excited to see them occurring because that just means there's more need and there's more demand for VFR.
Competition is always good because that means that you're onto something.
Hopefully.
Sounds like you are for sure. So you're a few years in now. I mean, what have been some of the biggest challenges in starting a drone manufacturing business here in the United States?
The biggest thing is figuring out what drone, like, how are we actually going to build the thing? We've been really fortunate to have a great team of engineers. Now, I built our very first product when we were working with just Pure Software, and we were able to build a team that basically took that core automation, that core technology, and put it onto different drone frames. When we started building Nighthawk, we went through about 6 different iterations of frames before we finally landed on one that to work. All right, our first one was this, you just buy things online. When you don't know how to do something, I usually Google it, and we didn't know how to build a frame. So we're like, okay, what frames exist? Can we use these frames? Can we get one unit working with our automation software? You know, it doesn't need to have a gimbal, doesn't need to have a great flight time. Can we do it?
Yeah.
Okay, we did. I don't know where it is, but it's here somewhere. But then once we know that we can fly, and we can fly autonomously, and we can fly beyond visual line of sight within these conditions, okay, how do we increase the flight time? What are the different payload options we want to look at? So it's managing all these different things and combining them together. And really, one of the biggest things is finding other people who are doing these little components significantly better than you are and finding ways to work with them, because none of this comes together with just one person or just one company. It's a massive team of not just Paladin, but our partners that we work with to make sure we're building a platform that's safe for first responders.
Now, I have a personal question because this is of interest to me. You are an engineer by trade. This is what you went to school for, and you obviously created this amazing platform. Now you're kind of, I'm not going to say forced into a business leader position, but you're a business owner, and then you also have to run the business on top of designing the drone. How has this journey been for you? Because I know I've done the same thing personally, and I'm always interested to hear, you know, how did that go? Was that something that was easy to catch up for you, or was that something that was pretty challenging because of your base training as an engineer?
Yeah, well, I wouldn't even consider myself an engineer. I went to college I was in Berkeley Engineering for 3 semesters, and I dropped out to start Paladin because, like, literally every single semester we had some massive fire or some death nearby in the Bay Area. Oh, my second semester on campus, our church, one of our churches burnt down. And there's smog everywhere. It took a really long time, and they did actually use a drone to help combat it, but that happened after an hour into the fire. Again, no one's fault. It's just no one had even thought of doing it in a different way. So I wouldn't consider myself an engineer, but in terms of starting this business, it's always been about building a product. Can we build something that works, right, for everybody? And over time, I've been fortunate to be just working with some of the best teammates I could have asked for. Our software leads, our growth leads, like Maxwell, he's my software lead. He's built Nighthawk from the ground up. I was like, hey, can you do this? He said, I don't know. It's like, all right, let's try to do something. And we got it working. And it's a lot of the pressures of starting a business are always there, right? Like, you're running a business, you want to make sure you're building a product, you want to make sure you have customers, mm-hmm. you want to make sure these things are going on. And all of that is helped when you have a great team. And when I was starting off, for the longest time, I was, you know, it was just me. And that's fine. That's what you have to do sometimes.
But as you do
that, build something that you can hopefully transfer on to others that do it way better than you do. Max is a phenomenal engineer. I'm glad he's taken charge of things because he's way better at it than I am. And that's what I try to do.
It sounds like you left college because you started to understand how important your idea might be and how it might help to save lives. Is that correct? Like, you left after 3 semesters?
Yeah, I was debating it for a really long time, like what to do, because this just seem to have an urgency. And college is great. You know, it's I think education is incredibly important. Everyone should pursue it. At that time, I was thinking, okay, I'm working on something here that might be really important. And I also obviously have my college. But at that time, I was thinking, this seems to have some sort of urgency.
Well, and that's where I'm getting with this question. It's like, you fully understood the importance of how drones can be used to help save people's lives. You left college for it. You took the risk to start your own company. In working with all these first responders, do you feel that people get it finally, that people understand that drones can be this important and this useful in those kind of disaster scenarios or like fires?
I think it's just starting to take off. I think it's so inspiring to see stories from, like, seeing success stories from departments using drones. And that now is translating to our departments trying DFR, and we're starting to see success stories, right? If we can say that we're able to de-escalate a situation, no one got hurt, right? Or we're able to help decrease the amount of time firefighters spend at a raging fire because our thermal camera can show exactly, hopefully, where everybody is, and hopefully come to a better outcome. Again, we're not the people risking our lives here. We're just trying to build tools that others can use really easily.
We've covered so many stories where there's a little kid lost, and it's the winter, it's turning dark at night, and there's all these volunteers trying to find a 4-year-old kid, and then there's one guy with a drone with a thermal camera finds the boy within 4 minutes. And this is not a one-off story. I can give you probably 20 at least in the last 2 years that are very similar and that show the importance of drones. Can we back up a little bit and go back to the 911 phone number and the drones as a first responder program. Like, you're supporting that. Can you tell us how it works and how you guys are involved in that?
Yeah, so that's what the company was started for. Again, sending drones to 911 calls. The entire concept is when someone calls 911, what type of information can they get across to the firefighters, to the police officers, to the dispatchers? Reality is not a lot. So when someone calls 911, if we have their general location, which again, they're calling, right? They're mm-hmm. trying to state where they are. Let's send the drone there first or at the same time. The drone launches the exact same time that firefighters are responding. But with the drone, you're not worrying about traffic, right? It's a straight line exactly to that location. So how we make this work is we have Nighthawk, our own drone, sitting outside of a fire station, centrally located in a city. Our software, Watchtower, is integrated with the city's software. So when a 911 call comes in, they are able to literally from the dispatch center, if they are Part 107 certified, they have that training, deploy a drone by clicking one button, by just clicking start. Yeah. The drone takes off and it arrives on scene usually within 90 seconds. Once it arrives, that video feed is sent to the firefighters who are on their way. The dispatcher who's on the phone trying to understand what's going on can see it right in front of them. We have dedicated screens in our cities for our video feed when the drone responds. And so far we've seen that this helps reduce response times, helps locate missing people, helps locate stolen cars without anyone getting hurt. And you know, we've been working with very small cities who've been so, they've just been so supportive of the entire program of working with a small company to work with, okay, these are the challenges we're seeing. This is how we're going to fix them. And now that's helped us build a product that we're taking to bigger and bigger clients. And that's exciting for us. That's exciting for the industry.
Yeah. So with Beckons, all the people that need to know now have a visual feed of the situation.
Yeah. And they can control that visual feed from their laptops. Wow.
That's amazing.
Can I ask, in case anything was missed, what else does the software and the back end offer for the first responders and their team?
Yeah, we've seen so many departments start drone programs or even buy drones, and they just don't get used because of either a lack of training or a lack of use cases. So on our software end, not only do we have a platform that automatically dispatches drones daily to 911 calls, it's fully integrated with all of the drones that we connect into the system, allowing you to manage the flight data. If there are recordings of it, everything is in one secure location. We know if anything is happening to our drones. If we're seeing subpar performance, we're able to notify the departments, hey, maybe we need to swap out the batteries, if the batteries need changing, or if we're reaching too many cycles. It's all comprehensive. And beyond that, all of the logging that we do that we're required by law, every single flight to submit monthly, it's all there, automatically uploaded through our dashboard, through our data management and collection system.
So I'm assuming that on the back end, all of this is done beyond visual line of sight because you're pushing a button, the drone takes off and goes and it's fully autonomous. What does that look like for your customers to get approval from the FAA to do this? Because we know that it's not an easy thing at the moment with the current regulation.
Yeah, beyond visual line of sight is something that's absolutely necessary for DFR to succeed. And we've been fortunate to be able to get waivers for our clients. And the reason we're able to is one, we're using Nighthawk, which doesn't lose connection when you fly beyond visual line of sight. There is no limitation of a controller and drone connection. You know, we constantly have telemetry, we constantly have video feeds. Beyond that, in every single operation, we have mitigations. So every single time a BVLOS operation is done, there is not only a pilot, a PIC as we call them, pilot in command, there are also visual observers throughout the city that are able to notify that PIC if any aircraft are coming their way. This entire industry is about mitigations, right? Making sure we don't have drones falling out of the sky, making sure we're able to deconflict airspace. And as we keep looking into more and more technologies that are able to do that, right now, every single one of our cities has a network of visual observers able to look at the airspace, notify anybody of anything coming our way. And all of our drones, all of our operations are geofenced, meaning if they're not, they physically cannot go beyond a specific boundary that we set on our software.
Yeah, I was wondering about that. And then the visual observer, did you mention anything about visual observer requirements?
Yeah, we have every single flight that we do conducting beyond visual line of sight has not only a PIC, but also a visual observer separately to be able to look at the airspace.
I mean, if you are operational in a certain town, that you have basically created a map of the town, identify areas where you cannot fly, identify areas where you can fly, try to avoid maybe flying over moving vehicles or flying over people. I mean, is that all built into the system, all those kind of parameters?
It's 100% built into the system. And when we onboard a city, the very first thing we do is we'll fly out there. We want to know exactly what the airspace looks like. Mm-hmm. And this is after we've already done analysis on it, submitted it to the FAA and gotten these waivers approved. We go out there with our team, map out exactly what that town looks like, what are the tall cell towers that we need to watch out for, tall buildings, and put them into our database. Because again, we don't want drones to be crashing, hurting people.
So that
safety is number one priority.
So this might mean that if your drone takes off from a firehouse and it goes to the scene of an incident, it might not fly in a straight line. It might actually go around certain obstacles or avoid certain areas in order to make that flight as safe as possible.
Exactly. If we know that there are areas that we need to avoid, whether for regulatory reasons or whether for just, hey, that's a really tall building, let's not crash into it. All that data gets put into our system. It's loaded onto the drone constantly, and the drone makes smart decisions. Well, we hope the drone makes smart decisions, and that's what we've been testing and confirming every single time before we go out and give this report.
So I can imagine if you have a city, let's say in Southern California, and it's a relatively flat landscape, it's sunny, it's beautiful weather. I mean, that's like an ideal setup, I would imagine. But now let's say if you're in, I don't know, Westchester, New York, where I live, where it's more hilly and there's more rain and more clouds and foggy conditions. Like, how do you factor those kind of things into your model?
We're very, very careful about the cities we work with. Yeah. As much as we want this technology to be everywhere, like, we're 100% recognizing that every single city is different. And there are environments that we should not be flying in. Yeah. You know, like, we're not going to be approaching Manhattan downtown and saying, hey, we're going to put drones everywhere. That's not safe. There's so much significant testing that needs to go on. The cities we work with are suburban, urban areas. Even if they have tall buildings and have hills, all that data is entered into our database, and our drone acts accordingly. But we definitely are careful about who we work with, at least initially, because we want to see more success stories. Yeah. We don't want to be trying something unsafe.
So does that mean you can fly in the rain, or you can fly, or do you have an IP rating for the drone?
There's no IP rating on the drone yet, but we do fly constantly in up to 2 inches per hour. Houston rains all the time. If you guys have ever been here, it's always raining, it's always hot, and we have to build our drone to be at least able to withstand those conditions.
Wow.
So we ask every guest on this podcast about remote ID. What is your opinion, and how do you think it's possibly going to impact your business?
I think remote ID is great. I mean, if you look at the existing aircraft and aviation rules, most aircraft need to have some sort of transponder on them to be able to recognize exactly where they are, ADS-B and something of the sort. There needs to be some sort of similar system for drones. And we already were able to give our drones exact identification, send it out to anybody who needs it. There is no set standard just yet, but if there ends up being one, great. I think it's super necessary. Like, in the cities that we're working with, they have private companies that are using medical evacuations. How do we make sure we're not crashing into each other if we don't have direct contact, right? Like, we set up communications and we set up radios and things like that, but there needs to be some sort of communication beyond just that. Air traffic control systems today exist, and they work really well.
So as a manufacturer, have you been working on a remote ID solution that meets the requirement for September 2022, which is this year, or are you going to rely on modules at the moment?
We have something that we've been working on, but we also know that there are several other modules that work really well. And for us, it's about finding whatever works best. If we can build it and it works exactly to specifications, great. If someone has a better solution and we can easily integrate, awesome. The goal is to build something safe, right? Something that works. And you only do that by working with others.
That's good to hear, actually. You're the first manufacturer that I'm talking to that's actually doing something. It feels like about remote ID. So that's interesting.
Well, it was before remote ID was a thing, when we were starting some pilots in Ohio, we had a medevac company and they're like, well, listen, we've got a helicopter pad right there. How do we communicate with y'all? And we're like, all right, well, just here's our drone's information.
Earlier in this conversation, you mentioned that you're not really restricted in terms of how far you can fly other than battery life, but not when it comes to the radio transmission. Do you guys not use radio transmission? Do you use a 4G network, for instance, or how does that work?
Our communication is basically a mix of everything,
yep.
Including radio and including 4G, as well as some others. The minute we are beyond radio range, the drone automatically transfers over to our secondary form, and that allows us to control this with about anywhere, usually less than 300 milliseconds of latency, although our average is around 100 or less.
And can you tell us what that secondary form is? Because it sounds like that's the special sauce, or not?
Maybe a little bit. We might have some announcements on that in the next coming weeks.
All right, cool. Thank you.
But as so of today,
Sorry. Oh, no, go ahead.
This, what we're using today is being used by cities. It's nothing that we're hiding or, you know, this is put into all of our waivers, all of our applications.
Yeah, yeah.
And the FAA seems to think it's at least a part of a mitigation.
Is like the rollout of the 5G network, is that relevant to you or important to you, where you would have access to a network that has much higher data transmission rates?
Potentially,
I figured. All right, cool.
And you guys are using obviously this kind of tech because you're in an urban environment or a semi-urban environment. We talked to a North Dakota testing site a couple of weeks ago, and they're developing this BVLOS network that would be able to provide, especially for flying the drone in itself, having their own towers and having their own network on the ground to help with that. Is this something that that would be helpful for you, or would you just prefer using existing technology, and because you're not in a very rural environment, it works for you?
I'd love to talk to them if you can get me in an email conversation and understand what they're building, because that sounds pretty.
You bet.
Our system today is built for urban and suburban areas. We're not building a drone yet, or our technology is not made for rural areas. And there are several solutions out there that work better than ours for those use cases. So if North awesome. Dakota has something they're working on, I'd love to see how we could work together.
Yeah, yeah, we'll put you in touch with Trevor.
I've been flying the Mavic 3 and the new Autel drones a lot, and I've seen a trend, and both take several minutes. I'm talking about 5 or 6 minutes the first time you fire them up to get about 12 satellites connected so that GPS is activated. Do you see this problem at all on your end? Is it just?
Yeah, not to 5 to 6 minutes, but our first cold start, mm-hmm. if you will, does take a couple minutes for that GPS to lock on. We're already working on a solution.
Oh, that's interesting. Can you share what solution or no?
until we release it, I don't know what it's going to look like. So when we release it, I'm happy to talk more about
NDA.
It. But we know that it's a massive issue.
All right.
Something like that. Well, it's a known problem, right? With DJI, Autel, both build phenomenal drones, and I'd say they build some of the best drones.
Oh, absolutely.
There's a reason firefighters, police officers use them. They're great for their specific.
I have a feeling that with your passion, you might get to a solution before DJI actually fixes it.
Well, we're here to learn, or we're here to teach, one way or the other.
So. Looking at your business and looking at the next 12 months, or let's say maybe 2 years, what would you need to be able to grow as fast as you think you should be able to grow? Like what's the biggest thing that would allow you to, I don't know, jump forward, if you will?
Unlimited
money. Is money a restricting factor? I mean, I know it is for me, but I mean...
The biggest thing is always the budgets of the departments we're working with. Again, we've been fortunate to be working with departments that have very successful UAV programs, and they have budgets, and they are believers in this technology, early adopters in it. The next year is crucial for us as we find more of these cities and start building out these use cases in these larger departments. Again, we've already flown thousands of missions and they've been with our select clients. It's going to be very exciting to see how that narrative around DFR is going to change as we spin up more and more pilots and this becomes more used really across the
country. Can you tell us more about how many cities and perhaps even which cities you're active in, or is that sensitive information?
The city that we're active in today is Memorial Villages Police Department right out of Houston, Texas. We've been working with them ever since 2019, and they've been a great, they've just been an absolute amazing department to work with. We're spinning up 5 new programs across the country. We'll be announcing them very soon, but we're very excited all across from one coast to the other and parts in between.
Oh, questions. Oh, sorry, so, Greg. how is your experience been working with the FAA when a young startup company like yours is trying to push the boundaries of the drone regulations?
It's been a surprisingly reactive process in that when we first started the company, there wasn't a lot going on in terms of finding ways to speed things up or even to create templates. But over time, the FAA has done kind of what I think is a really good job of making sure that we're continuing to push on the boundaries while still making sure things are safe. What that means for us is the first BVLOS waiver that we ever got took us about 8 months. Took a really, really long time, but for the right reasons, right? This is such a new thing. We were presenting something that really hadn't been tested all that often before, and there were several mitigations that we had to make. Today, we're getting them in weeks, following again the exact same mitigations, the exact same procedures, but it's the success of previous flights, the success of previous stories that help us speed along this process even more. And it's been great working with the FAA. They've got their job to do and we've got our job to do. And we're very excited to be working with them, submitting new proposals, submitting new waivers, and just always pushing forward. And I think the FAA is also just seeing so many departments wanting to use drones. They're seeing this, that, you know, you're not delivering pizzas. You're really trying to save lives. You're trying to find people. And that has such a higher importance. And the FAA is responding. More and more departments are getting waivers. More and more departments are conducting operations. And we're getting more and more BVLOS waivers.
Yeah.
That's good to hear. That's really good to hear. As a drone manufacturer, what is the feature or the features that you would like to see on your drone, but at the moment you just can't have that because of technology? What's the technology limitation that you wish you could just put aside and that would make your drone just perfect?
I think the biggest thing would be battery. If we can have unlimited battery, then we can put bigger payloads on the drone. We can add very, very, very fail-safe parachutes to the drone if we don't have to be worrying about, you know, how's that battery going to handle the how's all that going to work? If we're able to increase battery technology, that solves so many problems. Because the biggest thing for a drone is, one, how safe is it, right? Like, if it's up in the air, can we keep it safe? And second, what can you do with it, which is usually the payload and the range. So we've solved a lot of the payload issues, we've solved a lot of the range issues, but we want to keep making this safer. If we can have a 2-hour flight time with better batteries and a parachute on it, and you know, that kind of really helps decrease the risk to anybody who's underneath it for any reason.
And using a crystal ball, do you think this is something that we can realistically get to in the future?
I think battery technology with all the EV cars will be increasing. Wouldn't be the one to place a bet on where it goes in the future. What we know is with current battery technologies, we already have a drone that can get 55 minutes of battery with a payload. So how can we make that better, right? We have something that works. Let's keep making it better while making sure we're always on the lookout for other people doing great things with battery technology.
Yep.
So I fly commercially. I do photography, some videography, and of course, I insure my drones. What you're doing, though, is quite different. You have autonomous drones flying through urban areas, got a lot going on. So what is insuring your fleet of drones look like?
We have our own insurance. Every single drone that we put out there is insured by ourselves. And when we work with a city, we also usually add it into the city's insurance. It just depends city to city, how how their legislature looks
So I'm curious, how do you ensure it yourselves? Like, you don't go through an agency or a company? I mean, I go through someone.
Yes, we work with insurance companies. Okay, we don't have our own insurance. We have insurance on our drones that we use third parties for. We also usually have the drones onto existing city policies and city insurance. That's city to city.
I mean, relatively speaking, is it more pricey, or how do they price it out for you? What's the risk assessment?
It's definitely more pricey, right? Like, we're flying in these suburban urban areas, again, within FAA regulations, within these guidelines, but it's still something new. So those are some of the costs you eat in the beginning, but that's something we're very excited to see change. The main thing is, you know, what's it going to take to get autonomous drones in every city in the US? And the answer that I have so far is, well, it's going to take 10 people to say yes to trying this and seeing how that goes.
Well, I have a curveball question for you.
Here we go.
You knew this was coming. So what is your favorite drone to fly?
My favorite drone to fly is the Mavic Mini Air 2. Oh my God, what a great drone. It's great. I love it. It's so tiny. It's less than 255 kilograms. They put a 4K sensor on that thing. It's super stable. I think it's great. I think the fact that you can get a drone that safe, that just stable in the air for less than, what is, I think the without the Flymore package,
it is
less than $500 bucks.
It's tiny little case.
Amazing. It's an absolute, it's a great product. That would be one of them. The other one, I really like the Mavics. They're great drones. Although my favorite probably has been the Phantom 4. I know they don't make them anymore.
Awesome.
I want a Phantom 5.
That's a workhorse. Well, Divi, maybe. Haya will tell us when that comes out.
I haven't heard anything about the Phantom 5, but I think, Divi, if you like the Mini 2, then you might be getting excited soon.
I've heard
soon.
Or, let's keep it. Because you've probably seen the leaked patents and stuff. You know, Autel has a Nano, and I've been flying the Nano Plus, and they've put a 50 megapixel camera on, but they need a new firmware update because there have been a few camera profile issues. But anyway, I don't know if you've heard of that. Kind of the same idea.
I haven't flown a Nano yet. I'd love to fly one. I haven't flown it yet. The other really fun drone are like the ones that have no safety systems, or really tiny Pico drones that by themselves. They've got no stability, but you can crash it into any such wall, keep it indoors, you know, in a relatively safe environment, and just have fun with it. Those are really fun.
Awesome.
That's awesome. Well, Divi, thanks a lot for spending an hour with us talking about everything that you do. You're very passionate, and we definitely wish you a lot of success with the company. This has been a great discussion. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Greg. It was great to be on here. It was great meeting y'all in Texas. And if you're in Houston,
we'll swing by for sure.
Definitely. I wish I talked to you a few months ago. I was in Houston in December.
I think Houston's my favorite city by far. It has its problems. It has significant problems that need to be solved. It also has the best food. It's got great music. It's got great people, great energy. Anyway, this is not about Houston, but come on by.
We'll keep you up to that one.
I was there in 2016. They had a music festival, and it's slipping my mind. What's that?
The rodeo?
Not the rodeo. It was like a hipster music festival, like Aphex Twin was headlining or something. It was like December 2016. I think it was like Day to Night. It was Day to Night Music Festival. I've been to so many that they kind of just slipped my mind. But I agree with what you say about Houston. It is really cool. So
awesome. Well, if you enjoyed this episode, Pixel Drone Show goes out every Tuesday. We can be found on YouTube. We can also be found on any of the podcast platforms that you use. And make sure that you leave your comments down in the YouTube video. And then we'll see you next Tuesday for another episode.
Awesome.